So my name is John Sheehan. I'm going to be talking today about just some deeper issues of Windows 8 that I wasn't really able to cover earlier. I think I might even jump in and try to do a little bit of code. This is going to be very free form. I'm going to try to finish as early as I can because my expectation is between all the sessions you've seen thus far, plus some of the things I talk about here, you'll probably have lots of questions. So let's jump in. First thing I'm going to do, going to get out of the presentation. Got it all set up perfect, right? And I am going to go into Visual Studio. And I'm going to have to change so that so I can duplicate it so you can actually see what I'm doing. Perfect. Excellent. Close Outlook so you don't have to see all of my messages. All right, so let's go into Visual Studio. And I want to give you a little bit of tour of WinRT, because I talked about it a lot, but you probably really haven't seen what it looks like. So very quickly, I'm going to go and pull up what we call the object browser in Visual Studio. And as you can see, if I start scrolling down, there are a lot of namespaces. These are only namespaces. If you drill in, if I open up any one of these at random, you'll find some namespaces that have just a few classes in them, and some of them, like, say, storage, that have a whole lot of classes in them. I don't know what the exact count is, but I wouldn't be surprised to say that there are, are probably over 1,000 classes in WinRT. And these are the things that you're going to be using to build your apps. And to make great Metro apps. I think that you should find that they're very, very easy to use. One of our principles for designing APIs for WinRT is that we don't expect you to have to go off to the documentation and read a lot. So we do what we call IntelliSense or dot programming, where you type Windows dot, and you just kind of scan through. That sounds interesting. Take that dot. Something else comes up. And you just sort of dot your way around until you find what you want. Internally, we've been building lots of apps, and even people like me end up doing lots of IntelliSense and dot programming, and it's pretty easy. All right, so let's go ahead. I want to create a quick app. I'm not going to do anything too fancy, but I want to just show you a couple of things. Like, for example, I want to show you async. Because I talked earlier about how async, and there were lots and lots of things were async, and I want to show you what that looks like. So I will just do a blank application. I'll pick C Sharp. We'll just call it the DDC demo. And we'll let Visual Studio create the project for me. There we go. All right. So I'm just going to do probably the simplest thing that I can think of, which is I'm going to create a screen that has a button and an image tag. And I think, I've done this for people before. It's nice because it'll demonstrate how easy it is to do async programming. It'll also demonstrate how easy it is. Oh, look at that. So you didn't see that. I drag like this, and there's no problem. See how that works? In the defense of the Visual Studio team, I am running some random version of Visual Studio with a slightly less random version of Windows. So it's not always surprising that there are sometimes weird issues like that. So let's go ahead. We'll just create a button. I'm going to code and talk, which Alesh never really wanted to do, but it never really bothered me too much. So we'll call it Tap Me. Perfect name for a button. Me and it. Why did I not get completion on this? Interesting. All right, I should be getting completion. It's probably because that thing crashed. All right, this is going to be slightly harder, of course. And we'll go ahead and we'll just create an image tag. And we'll name it photo, because that's a really good name for an image tag. Just to keep it on the screen, I'll give it a horizontal. Can't type. Horizontal alignment equals center. do that. And very quickly, I'm going to try to close and open this file again to see if I can actually get IntelliSense, because as I said before, I wasn't kidding. IntelliSense programming is much easier. All right, we're going to have to wing it. So let's go over to the CS file, and we're just going to add a handler. We'll create a method. Async protected void, what I call it, tapped. Is that what I called it? And so I think it should be a source. And then tapped routed event args. All right, so let's compile quickly and see if I fat-fingered anything. And if I didn't, I expect tons of applause, because I couldn't even use IntelliSense there. There we go, hey? Exactly. All right, so what I'm going to show now is basically, let's go ahead and we will leverage one of the contracts that I was speaking about earlier to go and fetch a picture. And in this particular case, we just go ahead and there are these things called pickers in WinRT. And so we have all different kinds of pickers. But anytime your code pops a window and then it sort of leaves your app's experience for a second to go and fetch something for you, we call that a picker. In this particular case, we'll go to the Windows Storage Pickers, the File Open Picker. So we'll create a File Open Picker. One thing about this picker is you have to give it a file type. Otherwise, it doesn't know what you want to pick. So in this particular case, JPEGs are perfectly wonderful types. And so now we're going to get a file. And here's what it would look like normally if these were synchronous APIs, right? So I would just say, you know, I would ask it to pick me a file. So I'd say, you know, pick single file async, like that. Now, in this particular case, because it ends in that word async, and we were very clear, every method that is asynchronous, it will end with the suffix async. So you know. You can look right at the name of it. You know that it's asynchronous. Because it's async, I have to do an await. And this is all I have to do. Now, for any of you who have ever done async programming before, this probably looks as close to magic as you've ever seen. Right? I see a lot of people shaking their heads. Exactly. So what actually happens here is there's a combination of the compiler and the operating system are working together to make your life easy. You're welcome. So what happens here is when you see that await keyword, the compiler actually carves this up under the covers into two different methods. So you write one method, and what it does, it basically writes a method right up to the await keyword and then creates that one. And then for the stuff afterwards, it creates a whole separate method. And what it does is in between is it says, okay, I'm going to run this await operate or this async operation. The operation is going to start. It's likely going to run on another thread. This method is going to return to the message pump, and your UI is going to stay nice and fast and fluid, and it's going to stick to the user's finger. Some point later, once the async operation is done, the code that comes after the await, that's actually your like completion handler for the async operation. And then when it completes, that code starts running and it continues. And the nice thing about it is you can just do await, 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 await. You can have tons of them. And all inside of one function. And literally every time you type that word under the covers, a new method is being generated for you. And luckily, you just don't care. So, all right, so now I want to do something with it. At this point now, I've asked the user to go and pick a file. And already, my app now supports Facebook, Twitter, SkyDrive, everything, just by these couple lines of code. So this is all I had to do. I didn't have to go off and learn what the REST APIs are for fetching pictures from Twitter. It's completely not my responsibility anymore. So we're going to go ahead, and we need to get an image, basically. And so now you're going to have to bear with me, because in real time, I am now going to do some programming, because I actually forget where this is. I think it's under media. No, it's under graphics. See? I think it's under graphics, imaging, bitmap. No. Let's see where it is. This is the kind of programming that we expect a lot of people to do. And I'm literally not finding it right now. This is always fun. So I'm pretty sure it was under graphics, and I'm surprised that I'm not seeing it right now. It should be under imaging.bitmap. As the room goes very silent. You know, I've done this 100 times. In my defense, by the way, I wasn't supposed to do this talk. So last minute someone canceled, they said, can you get up there and do something? And I said, sure, I can do something. All right, well, first of all, let me run this as is, because this will already demonstrate the first half of the project. Wah, wah, wah. What happened there? Oh, when I oh, it's because I'm projecting. Dang. Well, that stinks. This thing is pulling me down to a lower resolution than actually is allowed for Metro apps. So let me see if I can, on the fly, fix it. If not, I'm going to go back to the slide deck, and you can just hear me talk, which, trust me, is very, very interesting. It really is. No, I can't. That's the highest resolution I can get. Oh, well, that's a bummer. The other one where I did the tech check actually had a bigger resolution. All right. So let's quickly go through the code a little bit, though, and just understand what's happening here, and then I'll switch back to the deck, and I want to talk about some other topics. But so basically, this await here, it actually is triggering UI that is going to leave your process, go to a protected process that the system owns, and go off and interact with the user. So when I talked before about app containers, in this particular case, I'm going to go get pictures, and they may be pictures on my hard drive, like even in my pictures library. Your app doesn't have access to that. So if you tried to bypass this mechanism and you tried to write like standard file code and you tried to go directly and get at the files, you will get accesses denied. Your process is running in a low privilege container that is not allowed to get at that stuff. So when you want to get access to something that's some of the user's data, you're forced to go through the system. And that's what this code does. This code says, okay, system, go pop the picker and have the user interact with the user and let them choose what picture that they want me to have. The user, without realizing it, they're just using what to them looks like an old-fashioned file open dialog, although, hey, it's full screen and it's beautiful and it's Metro and blah, blah, blah. But let's face it, it's a file open dialog. They're using a file open dialog and they're saying, yep, here's the file and I'll hit open. Without them even realizing it, they just made a security and or privacy decision. They said, this app that I'm interacting with is allowed to see this one file or two files or three files, depending upon how many they pick. This is one of the ways that we ensure confidence for Metro apps. And so you're going to see this pattern again and again and again. You're going to see await and async all the time. You're going to grow to love them. Because if you ever forced to write the code without them, you will realize how much heavy lifting they do on your behalf. All right, let's go back. And let me switch back to the other mode so that I can get a nice view of my deck. Let's see, shift to 5. There we go. All right, so next thing I want to talk about is this is very much a real-time presentation. I was watching the Twitter feeds after my talk, and someone was saying, roaming, that sounds really cool. I can't wait to see what that's like. So I figured, hey, if I have to get up here and talk, I might as well talk about something people are interested in. So let's talk a bit about the roaming in Windows 8. And first I want to talk about our principle for this. We spent a lot of time designing the roaming infrastructure, an insane amount of time designing the roaming infrastructure, because we wanted it to be dead simple for developers to use. We wanted them to get it right always and not get it wrong. But there are a lot of very hard problems underneath the covers when you're going to start roaming data on behalf of an app. And so, but the reason that we did it is that we really do believe that if you start building apps and they become islands where each device is a completely separate disconnected thing, that they will feel broken. Users are going to get used very, very quickly. Actually, it's already happened to me. You know, I use Windows 8 every day, And occasionally, some of the stuff stops roaming because of a bug on our internal SkyDrive implementation. And it's infuriating. You expect that when you jump from machine to machine to machine, your experience just continues and picks up where it left off. And so as you're thinking about designing your apps, think about roaming. Think about what is the user going to expect to get this thread of continuity across all the different devices that they have. Because they are going to have more than one device. I mean, it's just happening. We see it get more and more and more. Households and families have laptops, and they're going to have slates, and they're going to have desktops, and they're going to have more than one. And they really are going to expect that they get that great experience. But let's quickly take a look at when we started Windows 8 and we started having the talks internally, we were looking at how do applications store information for users? It turns out there's a lot of different places that we as the operating system give you like it's a gift. Yeah. You can put it in the registry, you can put it in configuration files, you can just dump it on the file system, you can create custom formats, and applications do all of these things. And one of the problems that we had was that we didn't have any rules. We should have had rules, but we didn't. We had advice. Like we would say, pick a spot in the registry and name the key after your app or your company, and make sure it's unique. And I guess you're probably assuming, how do you make sure it's unique? I don't know. I really don't. So people would go ahead and they would pick a spot in the registry and they would start dumping stuff in there. And then what would happen is other apps would end up using the same area. And they would dump stuff in directories and other apps might end up using the same ones. And it really wasn't a great story. And when we looked at this, we said, well, maybe we can just take this model, right? Because this was very early in Windows 8. Maybe we can just make that roam. Maybe we just do that. And, so we started looking at it. What would it take to get it moving across a whole bunch of different files? We were smart enough to figure out that the cloud probably played a role. Somehow or other, the cloud probably played a role. But it wasn't really clear how we would do this, especially if we were leveraging these existing stores that had no expectation of roaming. Like, when the registry was built, there was no concept of, hey, there's going to be this internet thing. And it's going to be huge, by the way. Did I mention that? And roaming's going to happen. And none of that stuff happened. And so when people use these things, your apps are designed to work on one system and have one view of the world. So what would it take to get continuity across multiple PCs, to get that roaming experience, to give the users that great experience? Well, you'd obviously have to set something up in the cloud. So you'd have to get yourself a domain and set up a bunch of infrastructure and services. You'd have to do a really big one is user management. Your users have to have a username and password. They have to remember them. You have to provide an experience for when they forget their password, because they're going to. I can't even imagine how many different user accounts I have across different websites, different apps, work, home, email. It's insane. And every time someone decides that they want to build a better experience, almost without fail, they end up creating yet another identity for me, John Sheehan, to have, and it's very frustrating. I'm lucky in that I found a name that no one else on the internet uses. So every time I go to a site, I always get it. It's Dumbnose. I am Dumbnose. There is no other. So every time I go to a site, at least I can pick the same username, and that helps me a little bit. But in general, most people don't have that, and they end up with random names on random sites all over the place that they can't even remember. So on top of that, you'd have to build sync infrastructure. Now, it turns out that that's a lot harder than you would think. There are so many edge cases when it comes to syncing large amounts of data through the cloud and replicating it out to other systems, especially when it's multi-master, meaning your app's running here, the app's running here, they're both changing data, and these changes have to flow up to the cloud and down that way, these changes have to flow up the cloud down that way. In the middle, you can lose network connectivity, you can have slow networks, you can have all kinds of different problems. You'd have to build that, and you'd have to do it in a way that worked pretty damn well for your users. And then hopefully you're going to be successful, right? We've already discussed that you guys are all going to get really rich, which means you're going to have millions of users. Well, that back end you build is going to have to scale for millions of users. Oh, and you're probably going to have to pay for that, by the way, which usually isn't cheap. And so that's where we started, and we decided we wanted to make it easier. And so we finally got it down to one line of code. For Windows 8, as a Windows 8 developer, you could do all that other stuff and figure out all of that, or you can just do this. This one line of code says, hey, Windows, that roaming area that you manage for me, go ahead and store value there and make sure that gets out to everywhere else. You don't have to care about the user's identity. We already know it. It's their live ID. You don't even have to know what it is. Like, we don't have to tell you what their live ID is. You just have to know that that person has an identity. The Windows knows it, SkyDrive knows it, and they work together to make everything happen. You don't have to do anything else. And so we think this is pretty compelling. We did try to get it down to zero lines of code, and it just didn't work. But we got there, which we think was pretty damn good. So how does it work? We decided that we didn't want developers to have to go off and try to manage the system themselves. So we do it on your behalf. When it comes to installation, uninstallation, data management, roaming, all those things, we create all the locations on your behalf when your app gets installed, and we give you an object that gives you direct access to them, and you don't even have to care where they live. And they may actually move over time, and you still don't have to care. It's the application data object, and basically it has a couple of different areas for you to store information. We give you some different folders. We give you a local folder. The local folder, all the files that you put in there are local. They don't roam. We give you a roaming folder, which kind of makes sense. It's a folder where you can put files, but those files roam. And we give you a temp folder. And the temp folder is a place that you can put stuff. You can put files that are, you know, sort of short-term use things, and the system will automatically clean them up for you periodically. On top of that, we give you settings. And settings are basically hierarchical name value pairs. And we give you two different locations for settings, roaming and local. And hopefully they speak for themselves. The one tricky thing about, well, first of all, before I talk about that, so basically, and these are the locations where we expect you to store your app's data. Now, notice there I said app data. This is application data. This is data associated with your app. And for example, let's say I'm using your app, and let's say you didn't do such a great job. Turns out I don't like your app. I uninstall your app. All this stuff goes away. The system automatically cleans it up for me. And because it's the app data, and I'm never going to use the app again, I don't care. If, on the other hand, you have an app and you use it to generate content, like, for example, let's say you build a video app, and I take all these awesome videos that I took of my daughter, and I use them to put in subtitles and everything. That's my data. If I uninstall your app later, I don't want to lose all the videos of my daughter. And if you cause me to lose all the videos of my daughter, I would be very unhappy with you. So in those particular cases, you should be using the contracts, and you should be using the file picker to allow the user to choose where they want to put their data so it lives in one of the libraries. Like, for example, videos would probably live inside the video library. So it's something you do need to think about when you start talking about data. Is this data really specific to my app, or is this user content that's much higher value? When it comes to looking at your data, there are certain things that you're going to want to roam. Like settings are going to be very important to roam. Sometimes part of that experience, like a good example is like if you think of like the Kindle app, you might want to keep track of the fact that I'm on page 127 so that when I go to another device, I don't have to start at one and start scrolling until I find my place. If it's a video app and I'm watching a video and I'm 23% of the way through, that's something you should probably roam so that if I go to another device, I can pick up where I left off. Those are the kinds of things you really want to roam. Things you don't want to roam are things like local caches, right? So if you build like a Facebook app, and you're showing you want to cache the last feeds in case like the user loses network connectivity, they can at least browse the feeds that they had already downloaded. That's great, but that should be local. You shouldn't be trying to roam that. that data already lives in the cloud. It's the truth is in the cloud. That's where the real data is. And so you don't want to be storing that. You don't want to be trying to roam that. You should just put that in the local cache. It's just something to think about. When it comes to using this data, even though it's roaming, you don't have to realize that. You're not required to do things like say, oh, what happens if we lose network connectivity? Does my code have to deal with loss of network connectivity? No, it definitely doesn't. You always just access the data locally, even if it's in the roaming folder. That folder is still just a folder on disk, and if the system's not connected to the internet at the time, doesn't matter. All that stuff is still there, and you can directly access it. But how does it actually roam? Well, under the covers, the system is always monitoring these roaming folders on your behalf. And as you're making changes, there's a separate sync service that is picking up those changes and is using a protocol to talk to SkyDrive. The data gets stored in the user SkyDrive, but it actually doesn't count towards their quota right now. That may change. We're still talking about that. But as of right now, it gets stored in a section of the user's SkyDrive where they don't directly see it, right? Because this is still app data. You know, it would be kind of weird for a user. Let's say you had some kind of weird XML format that you dumped lots of data inside of. What's the user going to do with that? Like, that means something to your app, but it doesn't actually mean anything to the user. So we hide it from the user so they don't see it. And because it's hidden from them, as of right now, we've decided that we won't count it against their SkyDrive quota. So it's like your little special area just for your app. The syncing happens when appropriate. We don't say a lot about when things get synced. It's usually pretty quick, but the thing that we have to be careful about is abusing the user's network, abusing the user's battery. Because if the network card is, let's say the network card's off right now, save, because Windows is saving battery, if we're constantly turning back on the network to keep syncing stuff nonstop, we'll drain the user's battery really fast. By the way, if you're going to build your own sync engine, those are the kind of things you need to think about. And also, they could be on a costed network, so every byte might be costing them money. And so we have to be very careful about those things. So we have an extremely complex set of rules that define when it is safe and good to move bits across the wire. In general, you don't have to worry about it. We will do it as fast as we can without negatively impacting the user. Consistency. So way back when I said, hey, why couldn't we just take the registry and just roam that? Wouldn't that be good enough? Unfortunately, the answer is no, because we don't know what assumptions the developer made about their different settings. So the real simple examples are things like, I have two numbers, and they represent a square. And I have code to make sure that they're always the same. And if I update one of them and then a sync happens, well, I would expect that these two separate values would always stay together and in sync as they moved. But we don't know that, right? And so in general, the system will roam settings individually. They assume that if you store two separate settings and you give them two different names, that they're orthogonal and that they can be roamed independently. If you have a group of settings that you want to roam as a unit, like, for example, let's say you're a mail client, and you let me specify a whole bunch of different mail. I can specify my Hotmail account, my Exchange account, whatever. You might want to take all the details about each one of those accounts, and you might want to store them inside a thing that we call a composite setting. And it's like it's just a group of settings that roams as a unit. What that tells the system is I have an expectation that these things are consistent together. If I make changes on two different systems, I either get the changes from system A or I get the changes from system B. I never get a merge if I get half from A or half from B, because then that could likely be broken. When you're dealing with files, as long as you have a handle open to the file, we will not roam the file. We will wait, because we assume that you're in the middle of modifying the file, and if we roamed it at that point, it would probably be corrupt. So we wait until you stop editing the file, you let go of the file handle, then the roaming engine then picks up the file and moves it. Files always are separate units of roaming, so you can never have two separate files that are like interdependent and need to roam as a unit. If you want that data to roam as a unit, you need to have a file format where you put it in one file. So that's all I'm going to talk about for roaming. I'm trying to get through this quickly. How much time do I have left? 20 minutes? Oh, yeah, well, that's not plenty because I want to give you guys almost that amount of time for questions because I assume there'll be lots of them. Very quickly, I talked about it earlier, so I really don't need to go into much more detail, but I am going to stress it again. And if you were my friend and we saw each other on a daily basis and had beer after work, I would tell you about this every single solitary day. Please think about the new app lifecycle for your Metro apps. You will be suspended. Occasionally, you will be terminated. And you're expected to do the right thing for your users because they're not supposed to notice. Users don't close apps anymore. They just switch around from app to app to app, and they assume that the system takes care of it for them. And we do. Windows will go ahead and spend the app, you know, so it's not using resources. If we get low on memory or something, we can kill the apps. We do it all automatically. But we require some help from you to make sure that your app, when the user comes back to it, that it's in a good state. And so we try to make this easier for you. In WinJS, if you're a JavaScript developer, there is a class called Session State. It is on the app object that gives you effectively name value pairs, or it's really a JavaScript object where you can just dump stuff in there. And anything that you put in there will automatically get saved for you during suspension. And if you get terminated and reactivated, it'll automatically get rehydrated from disk. We have a similar feature that, as of right now, it's in our samples for C Sharp. It's called the Suspension Manager. I wrote it one night in an all-nighter right before build because we didn't have anything because the feature got cut. Hopefully, we'll have something back in by RC. For now, I encourage you to look at the samples. All the samples use it, so you should see the thing being used everywhere. And every sample has it in there, and so you can take that file. It lives all by itself. You can just take it and drop it in your project. And that will give you, again, it's effectively a C-sharp dictionary where you can put objects in and they'll automatically get serialized. I'm not even going to talk about that because I want to get to the questions. And given the time right now, if someone wants to, not yet? Okay. So very soon, like in minutes, you should go to preview.windows.com. That is the URL where you can get the latest information about Windows 8. Like, I don't know, maybe let's just hypothetically say that we were going to release a new version any minute. That's the URL that would tell you how to get it. And so with that, I'm going to switch to questions, and my colleagues are going to keep watching that URL and let me know if anything happens. Because maybe by the time it time's up, we might be able to give you one or two more treats. And feel free to ask about anything. Like I said, this talk was mostly to grab a couple of key things that we hadn't talked about in this conference. But feel free to ask anything.
You said before that you took care of when it got synced to the cloud. Can you force a sync?
No.
No.
The reason. So we looked at this. We had insane fights internally. People were very passionate on one side or the other. The reason that we decided not to is that if we do allow them to do it, then an app that is well-intentioned but maybe not so well-written can have a very negative impact on the user. And so we didn't want to give the developer the ability to, you know, to harm the user. And so we decided that we would do our best to make it happen very, very fast so that the app shouldn't have to really worry about it. If you need 100% guaranteed real-time, like, you know, sub-second sync, then you should be using your own cloud service. And you could go look at building something on top of Azure. That probably wouldn't be too hard to build. But in general, we believe that the syncing that we do is great for the 99% case.
Will there be any kind of support for older versions of Windows? I mean, some updates, service packs or something, so you can run the applications on Windows 7 with some...
No. On the other hand, but the one thing I will say is that the Windows team, we have done a ton of work to make sure that your Windows 8 is going to run on your Windows 7 software. As a matter of fact, if you look at the minimum hardware requirements, all the way back to Vista, from Vista to Win 7, they didn't change. From Win 7 to Win 8, they didn't change, which means that the minimum requirements for Windows 8 are the same minimum requirements that we had for Vista. On top of that, it's actually more efficient now. If you take Windows 7 and Windows 8 on the same hardware and you boot it, Windows 8 uses less resources, sometimes significantly less. Like on some of the systems we were seeing, just on booting and using it was using like 120 megs less memory. The fundamentals team in Windows have done a phenomenal job. And it boots faster. I mean, especially if you have UEFI, like my laptop boots, I think, 7 seconds. It's mind-boggling fast. And so we believe that if someone has Windows 7-capable hardware and they want to run Metro apps, that they can upgrade to Windows 8. We've also done a bunch of work on the upgrade to make it much better than it was in 7 or previously. But no, it would be an insane amount of work for us to try to get all this stuff working down in Win 7. It would be astronomical.
Windows 8 will be both an x86 and x64 and the ARM architecture. What limitation will the ARM architecture have compared to what you can call legacy applications, such as if you have an old WinForms application? What will the .NET framework in the ARM version support?
So the ARM version is a full-featured version of Windows, but we do not have an x86 emulation layer or anything like that. The only thing that ARM Windows will run is ARM code. We have focused primarily on, obviously, Metro apps and making sure that your Metro apps will run great on ARM. And so the ARM story is being... Technically, internally, it's even still being worked out right now. It's one of those interesting points in time where we have a new platform, and we have a goal for the ARM devices that they really be like consumer electronics, that they just work. And so over the coming months, you will see blog posts and other communications from Microsoft kind of rounding out the ARM story. So stay tuned. No, really? Wow, we did an amazing job. Like, this is all of Windows 8. You guys get it all already. Perfect.
When you talked about the security, you said that the user made a layer of security without knowing it, but they have had to pick everything. But how can you still make an app like a media player that has a library that automatically scans a folder or something like that?
Yes, you can. And so as part of our model for app containers and our security model, we have these things called capabilities. Now, we have a very small number of them, and that is by design. It's a constraint that I put on the team that they hated my guts for a very long time. But I think that at the end of the day, it worked out really well. One of the capabilities that you have is you can get a capability for the pictures library, for the music library, or for the video library. If you have that capability, you can go through the WinRT file APIs to get access to those files. Now, you're still going through that broker process to do the file open. But the way it works under the covers is the broker basically duplicates a handle back into your process, and then all file I/O that you do is at native speed. So you are doing file I/O in process, but your process doesn't have direct access to those files. Meaning if you use like create file, if you think of like the old Win32 create file, and you try to directly access that same file, you would get accesses denied. And interestingly enough, with the way that the security model works in the kernel for Windows, you can actually be reading and writing to the file, and then you try to do a create file on it, and you'll get accesses denied. Because you do not have direct access to it. But yes, you can build those apps. And actually, to make those apps easy, are the WinRT file APIs. They have a whole bunch of functionality around doing searching and automatically handling things like different kinds of extended properties on files. So if you think of things like music, the system knows about MP3 and all these different formats. And so if you want to know what album it's from, you don't have to go and figure out how to do it. You just ask the system, what's the album? The attribute album, and you'll get it back. You want to know who the artist was, what was the year that it was recorded, all that kind of information. The system knows how to already, we already have a system in Windows for doing that. And so you can do queries. You can even do advanced queries with those file APIs to say, okay, give me all the music that was recorded between 1963 and 1969. And we will give you back just that information. So we definitely make sure you can build those kind of apps. The one thing is that when the user goes to buy your app on the store, they will see that this app is going to get access to all of your music. And then the user can decide at that point. If it's a tic-tac-toe app and it's asking for all of my pictures, I probably will not buy that app. If it is a music player app and it wants access to all my music, that makes sense.
I have a question about the suspension functionality. If we have, you could say, Office 2010, and we all know sometimes it just crashes and you have this kind of very interesting file name of your old Word document. That will not happen now, but what if I still use this Office 2010? Will it then have get a small patch just to save itself, or will we still have that kind of problem?
So Office 2010 is a desktop app. It's not a Metro app. So it doesn't have the same app lifecycle rules. We did look at saying, hey, maybe we can take the app lifecycle stuff and do it to the desktop apps as well. Unfortunately, there's so many. It was just interdependencies, and this app over here has a COM object that's running in that app over there. The desktop does have some policy applied to it. Effectively, when you're using one of these Slate devices, either an ARM device or an iSOC device, they have this new mode called AOAC, Always On, Always Connected, or sometimes we call it Connected Standby. With those devices, when you push the button and the screen goes off, the device is still alive, meaning like let's say if you have the Skype client on it, like the Metro Skype client on it, you can still get calls, and the device will wake right up. It is not sleep like traditionally today, like when you close your laptop lid. When you close your laptop lid, that machine is dead to the world. When you turn the screen off on these devices, it's not dead to the world, but the desktop is. So when you turn the screen off, the entire desktop and all the apps on the desktop, they all go to sleep at the same time. And that's the only way we were able to apply policy to them. So Office 2010 being a desktop app is going to work the same on Windows 7 as it did on Windows 8.
I'm a little worried because what about a Windows Server? When will our server apps suddenly suspend and then kill themselves?
It's only Metro apps that this happens for. This Metro apps the only happens for, and we don't run Metro apps on server, except for terminal services. Like if you say, hey, I have this server, but it's really supposed to be, hosting a whole bunch of client apps, you can run Metro apps on that. But other than that, your server is not affected by this at all. So yes, if we had done that, I would be as concerned as you are. But we didn't. Don't fall.
About the security on the Metro platforms, mm-hmm. You said before that you haven't touched the keyboard input in any way. Are you not then open to macro hacking, like a keystroke. So let's say that you send 50,000 keystrokes in 10 seconds. That's impossible for a human to do, but a macro hacking could do that.
So when I said I was talking about keyboard input, so we have actually done a whole bunch of work. Actually, the work that we've done in App Container, I've given a 6-hour talk on it before. And at the end of it, there was no time for questions. It's a lot of work. You can think about it. The best way to think about App Container is, and this is sort of how we did it in our minds. We kind of started with low IL. So with low IL, you have this concept of they have blocks in there for shatter attacks and all that kind of stuff. Low IL is not really particularly secure, but it's a starting point. It was a logical starting point for us. And one issue with low IL is there's only one. So if you're running 100 apps all low IL, they can attack each other and get at each other. And so the App Container was designed to be a separate container for every single app, gets their own. That container actually has a security identity. There's a SID associated for that app. And the way that the low levels of the App Container stuff worked is we actually went in and changed this kernel function called SE access check. An access check is every object that's protected by an ACL should be calling access check. And all access check does is it takes a token and it takes an ACL and it says yes or no. That's all it does. It's really simple, results. Either access is allowed or access is denied. And typically, and this is one of the big problems with operating systems today, typically the software runs as you. Anything you can do, it can do. So yes, it's a tic-tac-toe game, but because you have permission to go out to the network and delete every file on your share, including all of the reports you've ever written for your boss and all the spreadsheets you've ever done, because you have that permission, tic-tac-toe also has that permission. We kind of think that's stupid. And so we did App Container to say, no. We know a lot more about this thing than just it's the user. We also know the identity of the app. And so when we do an access check now, it's a two-phase thing. We've never actually inside of access check ever been able to do and before. It was always just user or not. Now we can say both the user has to have access because running in an App Container is always a reduction in privileges. It's never an elevation of privileges. So first we do the traditional access check and we say, does this user have access to this resource? If the answer is no, we're done. It doesn't matter what App Container it is. The user doesn't have access, we're done. Then step two is, okay, the user has access, but now does the app have access? And only if both of those checks succeed does the whatever the function is then get back yes it's allowed and then things will continue.
Yeah, I was thinking about security in the new Microsoft Live identity. Is that inherent into like when you go to work? Can you then use the same Live ID account as I do now in my MSDN account? Is this linked to my Live account? So, like, when I migrate from a home computer, I could say, oh, I want to log into this user account on my work. Or...
Yes. So what you can do is, this machine right here, I'm in an AD domain called NT Dev, because I'm a developer on NT. And yet, at the same time, I also have my Live ID connected to the account. And so in the control panel, there's basically, you go in and look, and you can say, connect my Live ID. And then you can put in the Live ID credentials there. At that point, because it's a domain-joined machine, stuff isn't going to start roaming to it immediately because there's a bit of concern that maybe you don't want things to just start roaming there. And so you actually have to then verify it by going to to the Live ID site, and you can say, you confirm, yes, this is a trusted PC, and then we can start roaming stuff to it. On top of that, in the control panel for that machine, you can choose which things you can turn on or off. You can say, you know what, it's fine to roam my IE history, my browsing history. You can roam my browsing history, yay. Do not roam my usernames and passwords, like saved usernames and passwords. So you get that level of control. And administrators can always turn it off with a group policy. So if you're enterprise and you say, you know what, that's nice and all, but I don't want any of my users doing that. They have their home Live ID stuff and they have work and I want them to remain completely separate, they can go ahead and use a group policy to turn that off.
I can see you have been inspired a lot by iOS in what we have seen so far. What about support for animation and touch? Do we also get to the iPhone level in these areas?
So our touch and animation support, I think, are far superior to all the other platforms out there. And I'm not just saying that, by the way. I'm dead serious. When we get to do all of the performance stuff, like in to all honesty, we don't actually spend much, we don't pay much attention to what the competitors are doing. It's just not how we operate internally. But we did know that we needed very high performance stacks. It's one of the reasons why we deprecated almost all of Win32. Like if you look at Win32, I think by the full count is somewhere on the order of 490,000 APIs. Almost 500,000 APIs. Yes, that's counting the A and W ones as separate APIs, so you know it's might not quite be that bad, but it's huge. We deprecated almost all of it. And some of the ones that we deprecated were things like GDI. And the reason we deprecated GDI is because you just can't hardware accelerate it. And so across the board for Metro, everything is hardware accelerated, everything. We use DirectX under the cover for everything. If you're building a XAML app, you're getting DirectX hardware acceleration. If you're building a JavaScript app in HTML, you're getting DirectX hardware acceleration. If you're building a DX game, you're actually getting hardware acceleration. And we even do things like we have separate threads that run and do nothing but handle the animations. So we've done a lot of work to make sure that the touch performance is rock solid and really fast and very efficient, 5 minutes, but also that all of the animations and everything render at full speed, full frame.
So it sounds like the app container is connected to the drivers in the hardware. What happens if it crashes?
Well, there is. So that's interestingly enough. Like, we talk about the app container like it's a thing, but it kind of ain't. The app container is basically an extra entry in your token. So there's no process or entity running that is the app container. The fact that the process has this identity in the token means that all the parts of the system that pay attention to security and to really to access all get it for free. So there's no such thing as an app container crashing. Luckily enough, it was one of the things we did very early in Windows 8. It was going to be an extremely challenging project. We had never done anything like it before, and so we started early. And luckily enough, it stabilized very quickly, and I can't even think of the last time that we had an app container bug. Scary as that sounds, like it's been a long time. So as far as we know, it's completely stable, and it's really by design because it ended up the way that we did it. There was very few code changes to make it happen.
It's not just Windows; it's Windows and Tiles. What do you think the natural progression is for Windows? In other words, what will Windows 9 be like?
Wow, if I knew that, I would be rich. We don't know what Windows 9 is going to be like. Obviously, we haven't started working on it yet. We're still trying to finish Windows 8. When you said it's Windows and Tiles, you mean the overlapping Windows?
No, I mean that you have the Metro, which is very tile user interface, but we've still got the old Windows.
Oh, you mean the desktop?
Yeah, the desktop. Yeah.
No, so I'll tell you honestly, like that is not for us some kind of compromise at all. We firmly believe that there's great utility in both of them. Because if you think about it this way, there are certain operations that you do that work just great in a, you know, in a touch kind of model, right? There's tons of stuff you can do there. But would you want to do everything there? Like, would you want to do your development there? Right? Would you want to say, hey, having a high precision pointing device and a device that lets me input text very rapidly, we believe that's a good thing. Having overlapping windows is not evil. There's great things that you can do with overlapping windows that you couldn't do if you didn't have overlapping windows. We just think those are advanced scenarios. We think that they're more about like the kinds of experiences that you really only do if you're a hardcore Windows user. And so we had looked at, you know, early on, said, what if we just got rid of the desktop altogether? What if we did that? And it was never a good outcome because you would lose the environment that was designed to work great with, you know, with a mouse and a keyboard, you know, exclusively, and have all those overlapping windows. And so we do think that like different users of Windows will spend different amounts of time inside of different environments. You'll have lots of users that they're at home and they spend almost all of their time in Metro. You'll have other people who are at work and they spend almost all of their time, you know, working in Photoshop on the desktop and, you know, and writing documents, you know, long form documents. And we think that's great. Like that's the intent. We did it on purpose. It wasn't a kind of compromise to get the product out the door. And so internally, we're not talking about the death of the desktop at all.
But it's as though they're taking two separate paths. I'm thinking, do you think they might come together to a greater extent at some stage?
Oh, sure. I will say that we focused on Metro because when we started Windows 8, we looked at it and we said, you know, we have a very rich, very functional desktop environment. We have like a couple billion lines of code here. And for the Metro side, we had zero lines of code. So we kind of had a focus here, and that's where we put our effort. Over time, there's nothing to say that you couldn't have an app. Just because it's running on the desktop, does it still have to be you? Just because it's doing overlapping windows, does it mean that it should also have higher access to your system? No, not necessarily. And so we could see lots of different things happen. I'm not going to speculate on any of them because I'm not supposed to. We just don't really know. We'll see. We'll ship Win 8, and then we'll plan for Win 9, and then we'll come out with something hopefully great, and hopefully you'll love it. Or maybe I won't have a job.
Maybe. Back to the ARM question. Mm-hmm. And desktop. You couldn't quite answer it before. Will there be any desktop support in the ARM, or is it still uncertain? Or
no, there's still the desktop still exists in ARM. Like there's not again the perception that the desktop is antiquated or something like that just is the wrong perception. And I guess because we spend so much time talking about Metro because we're trying to teach you about it, it does sort of feel that way because we don't spend much time on it. You know, it's like having two kids. If one kid he's sick or something, you have to spend more time with them. You might be neglecting the other child. We still love the desktop. We still love our child. And so, yes, there 100% is a desktop on ARM. And, yes, you will run software there. In general, I think most people think that ARM devices people will spend a lot more time in Metro. But that doesn't mean that the desktop isn't there. It is. We're out of time. Thanks a lot, everyone. Sorry, I forgot to do this. Just like last time, if you have good feedback, please fill it out.